The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 307 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Here, the final edition of the Sound Off for 2013. It is Sunday, December 29th. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody who celebrates had a very Merry Christmas and got what they wanted from Santa. I know one person who didn't, Anderson Silva. Dear God, did you see that fight last night? His leg snapped in half on a kick, very reminiscent of the Sid Vicious injury on Nitro all those years ago. Just gruesome stuff. And Ronda Rousey, now with 8 straight armbar submission wins. You watch that and tell me that women can draw. If only WWE could find themselves a Rousey to draw with, someone they could build that whole Divas division around, maybe people would start to actually care. But anyway, enough of that. Some of you guys have been begging me to bring back Match Anatomy. There has not been a Match Anatomy segment on this show since episode 244 of the Sound Off. And if you are one of those people, you're in luck this week, because at least for 1 week only, it is back. During this week's NXT review, we're going to be talking about Antonio Cesaro and William Regal and breaking down everything that helped make that match work so well. It's not the best match I saw all year, but it was great for different reasons, and we'll get into why. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But first, some PayPal shout-outs. I want to give a shout-out to Anthony McGregor, John Gormley, Wayne Baker, Xavier Hacking, and Alan Carter, all of whom made PayPal donations to the show this past week. So I want to say thank you to each one of them. And if you want to make a donation, it's the quickest, most direct, easiest way to support the show if you like what you hear every single week and want to continue to hear the Sound Off. So go to thesolidmonster.com. You'll see the little box on the right-hand side. And just give what you can. Give what you think is appropriate, whatever you think the show is worth. And just know that I appreciate that. So you can do that on thesolidmonster.com. We also got a very entertaining email for the mailbag this week from somebody who stumbled across a video. The way he describes it almost as a shoot on me. I guess a video that somebody recorded a few months ago that I knew nothing about, and he brought it to my attention. And I'll save that for later on. We'll get into that, and I'll even play some of it here on the show. Very entertaining stuff. So that'll be later on. First, no Raw review on the show this week, because I already did one on YouTube. If you missed it, I did go ahead and record a 20-minute Raw review on our YouTube channel, so you could type in the Solid Monster, all one word, that's my username on there. You can subscribe to our channel. It's my review of the Battle for Christmas edition of Monday Night Raw from last week, a show that I think, as most of you probably figured, was largely just a waste of 3 hours, a throwaway show. There were some noteworthy things, a couple of noteworthy things on the show, I thought, that did not make it completely, totally, absolutely missable. Even though mostly it was. But you can go on YouTube and check out my full review. It's up there. I'm not going to get into that again here. And so you're aware, Raw, the first Raw of 2014, it's been announced, is going to be an old school show. They're going back to the old school theme for Monday Night Raw. That's January 6th, the first Raw of the new year. I guess they're up against the BCS title game that night, so I guess they feel they need to go with a theme show to try to boost ratings that night. So that'll be coming up on January 6th. I like the old school shows. You don't want to do them too often because then it just becomes annoying for the newer fans. I like it. You know, I like a little bit of nostalgia every now and then. I thought the very first one they did in 2010 was awesome. The last one or two they did, I don't really have too many memories of. So I guess maybe they weren't quite as good. I don't know who they're going to bring back for the show. My guess is it'll be a lot of the same faces that work behind the scenes and that they usually bring in. But I guess that's something to look forward to on January 6th. Instead, in this spot here where I would normally talk about Raw, I'm going to get into some live thoughts from the WWE at Madison Square Garden. They had their annual post-Christmas holiday show at MSG this past Thursday. I was in attendance for that show. I think it may have been the first show at the Garden since the Hall of Fame in April, which I also attended. Bob Backlund, if you remember back at the Hall of Fame, especially anybody who was there in the building that night, Backlund was a crazy man at that event. And he was a crazy man here, too. He wasn't part of the show, but he was there signing autographs and taking pictures out in the lobby. But I had a fun time. You know, $35, it was a kind of a last-minute decision. You can't really go wrong at that price. I was surprised by how full the building was. I don't know if it was legitimately sold out, but if it wasn't, it was pretty close. The entire building was packed in. And even without CM Punk, without Daniel Bryan, The Shield, The Wyatts, I think even Ziggler and Barrett and Miz and Kofi, all those guys were in Chicago. They were doing the Chicago loop, so they weren't at this show. Nobody seemed to be complaining. One cool thing about the renovations they've made at Madison Square Garden, for those who don't know, they've been spending millions of dollars to renovate the garden. So to a lot of us who have gone to this building for a number of years, when you walk in now, it almost doesn't even look like Madison Square Garden anymore. You know, that iconic short aisleway, I'm sure many of you know what I'm talking about, isn't even there anymore. There's now a catwalk up, which is kind of cool, actually. I have not been up there, but there's a catwalk up that you can walk across. So there's a lot of new things that they've added to the building, and they've kind of updated it. But one cool thing about it is that they now have these giant screens above the ring where you can watch the matches, which is helpful if you're really far from the ring, especially at a live event. We weren't all the way up, but we were pretty high up, and we also had some flat screens that happened to be right in front of us. So when they would cut to footage of the matches, because they actually shot the matches, and you can watch the video screens if you wanted to, there was this one static camera angle, and it reminded me of those old Boston Garden House shows they used to air on TV, or the shows from the Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto, which they still sometimes show on WWE Classics. That's exactly what it reminded me of, so took me back a little bit looking at the footage up on those screens. But let me just run through this really quickly here. I know some of you may not care. It's just a house show. But just some observations as somebody who, I don't even remember the last time I was at a house show. Oh, I guess it was a year ago. So there you go. I almost completely forgot I was at the post-holiday show last year. The point is, I don't go to very many house shows anymore. You know, if I go, it's to a WrestleMania or it's to a TV show or an ROH, you know, event at the Manhattan Center or something. So it's a slightly different perspective than I'm used to because I don't go to as many of these anymore, but it was still a fun time. Rey Mysterio was out there dressed up as Spider-Man. He wrestled Alberto Del Rio and beat him in the opener. Rey, in person, does not look like he's missed many meals during his recent time off. He is a lot bigger. He was favoring his knee early in the match, but after that he seemed to be okay, but it's clear that his knee is still giving him problems. By the way, Michael Hayes was sitting next to the stage watching most of the matches all night long, and even high up where I was sitting in the 200s section, I spotted him right away because he was wearing an all-white suit. I mean, I could be blind in one eye with an eye patch over the other, and it would still be impossible not to spot this man from that distance. Zack Ryder won a match. He beat Brodus Clay, who came out demanding to be called the main event player. Ryder did not get a lick of offense in during this match. He just rolled Brodus up for the win. So it was striking to me how not over Zack Ryder was in that building after being there 2 years ago at Survivor Series when the entire place couldn't shut up for 2 seconds. They were shouting his name and loudly, too. The entire show, they chanted, "We want Ryder." Even during The Rock's post-match speech that night. That was The Rock's first match back in 8 years, that tag match he did with Cena. Showing off the air, he took the mic. He's cutting a promo. And The Rock gets shouted down by chance of "We want Ryder." And it was so loud that Rock had no choice but to acknowledge it, and he put the guy over on the mic. So, I mean, that just goes to show you, that was only 2 years ago. That's not a long time. So whatever they had in this guy, I'm not saying he would have been main event material. I don't think he is main event material. But whatever they had in Zack Ryder, they have sufficiently killed it. So good job, WWE. Mission accomplished. Before the show, they did a deal where you could text your vote for either a Santa's Helper dance-off or a Santa's Helper match with the Divas. I prayed for a dance-off. The dance-off won, and we ended up getting a match anyway. It broke down into a brawl in about 30 seconds, the dance-off did, so then Brad Maddox came out, turned it into a match. I swear to God, I completely forgot that Maddox was the Raw GM. When he first came out, I'm like, who is that? And it took me about 3 seconds to realize who it was. I can't even remember the last time I saw him on Raw. I mean, is there a more pointless position of authority in that company on TV right now than Raw GM? They've got Triple H, they've got Stephanie, they've got Kane out there making matches. I don't see the point of even having a GM at this point. So anyway, Team Total Divas beat the Non-Total Divas, which did not include AJ Lee, so I lost interest. Sin Junico beat Curtis Axel in a boring match. Axel bitched on the mic afterwards that he wasn't going to end 2013 like this. He demanded another opponent come out. And out came the Great Khali. And about an hour later, he finally reached the ring. And then he beat Axel with a brain shot. Crowd liked Khali, so there you go. Then they constructed the steel cage. We were getting a cage match on this night. Usually they just lower the cage from the ceiling, so this also felt a little bit old school to me. They took the time to actually construct it from the ground up. It was Cody and Goldust defending the titles against Swagger and Cesaro. This was by far the best match on the show, at least until the main event. Goldust continues to amaze. The guy is just awesome. I almost don't even want them to break up now. You know, it seems too early for them to break up. I did that whole segment on the show when I answered a mailbag question a couple of months ago. I gave this whole outline about how I would book a feud, how I would book a breakup between Cody and Goldust that would culminate in a match at WrestleMania. And I like the idea. And if they do break them up, I hope they go with that idea that I proposed. It was on Sound Off 297. I remember that. But if they don't, I won't mind at all if they decide to keep these guys together. They're that good as a team. And they're over. The people love him. Cody got the hot tag. He got a chance to shine for a change. Usually it's Goldust getting all the attention and the applause. But Cody got his moment during this match when he climbed to the very top of the cage and performed a moonsault off the top of the cage. I know it's Madison Square Garden and all, but it's a house show, for crying out loud. He's a crazy man. But it looked great. I still worry every time I see Cody do that moonsault. I've said it on the show before. I almost wish he would stop doing it just because it looks so reckless and dangerous when he does it. I think part of it is, you know, it's a beautiful move. I think it's the person who I point to when I think of who does the best moonsault in wrestling, who does the best looking moonsault in wrestling. I always think of Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle is the best that I've seen at performing a moonsault. My opinion. Maybe you've seen other people, indie guys, I don't know. But Kurt Angle, to me, every time he does a moonsault, it just looks fantastic. And Cody's not far behind, you know. It looks great. The problem is, I think after what happened with Zema Ion and Jesse Sorensen in TNA, when Zema did a moonsault on the outside, he came right down on top of Jesse's head, and that's what caused his injury. When he suffered the broken neck and he was paralyzed for a little bit, they didn't know if he was going to walk again or wrestle again. And I mean, it was a freak accident, but when Cody does it, it's almost like he goes straight up and he comes right down, and it looks like he's coming right down on the other guy's head. And it just scares the hell out of me every time he does it. But again, it looked great here. The place went nuts for it. I think for a lot of people, especially younger fans, who, you know, were on Twitter afterwards raving about it, it's one of those moments that I think people will well, remember, because it was actually a really special moment, and it was impressive than some other, you know, moonsaults I've seen from the top of a cage. Not as impressive as Kurt Angle. I still think that moonsault that Kurt Angle did in TNA onto Mr. Anderson, he missed most of Anderson's body. He kind of landed on his face, but I mean, go on YouTube and watch that. It's one of the sickest things I've ever seen as far as the height that this guy gets on it. And you know the kind of condition physically that Kurt Angle is in, that his knees are in. He did that in a cage match on Raw many years ago against Benoit and blew out his knee. Or both knees. And this was even higher. I don't know how he survived it. So this wasn't quite as impressive as that. But what made this impressive was, like the Angle one in TNA, what we see in WWE sometimes is because they lower the cage from the ceiling, usually you have, it's like a support beam in each of the four corners, and you have that support beam that you can hold on to for some support so you don't lose your balance and fall off. And like in the match with Kurt and Anderson, there was no support beam. It was just the cage. They built it, again, from the ground up. So when Cody got up there, he had to take the time to balance himself and not fall over, and that can't be an easy thing to do. So much respect to Cody Rhodes for this. It was just a really cool moment. He did a backflip from 10 feet up onto Antonio Cesaro and won the match for the Brotherhood, as it should have. That move should not be used for a near fall. It won them the match exactly how it should be, and it was a great moment. Los Matadores and El Torito beat 2MB and Ricardo Rodriguez. Heath Slater is out until next year. He's not injured, but he's out, and we'll just leave it at that. The Matadores won in a match that I thought would never end. It felt like they gave this match 25 minutes. Probably was a legit 15. I mean, it was way too long for these guys to be out there. On the plus side, El Torito won the match for his team. Nobody around us felt really like he looked out of place. I'm sure had we seen this on television, it would look ridiculous having anybody other than Ricardo or any of the 3MB guys taking bumps for the little guy, but he was a total star in there. This guy has a reputation coming up from Mexico as one of the best performers in wrestling, even though he's a mini, one of the best. And WWE has not allowed him to show what he's really capable of. All we see him do, he comes out, he does the little bull run, he'll bounce off the ropes, and that's about it. That's really all we ever get to see on TV of this guy. It almost makes me wish they would build a minis division around this guy. I've suggested this before. You know, when Raw went to 3 hours, I said, they've got to come up with ideas to make the show feel different. So in other words, don't just fill the show with 3 hours of the same garbage that we got on a two-hour show, but add a minis division or a cruiserweight division. I mean, I'm just throwing ideas out here. And they never did that. And that's one of those things I actually kind of liked about Nitro back in the day. When Nitro went to 3 hours, I'll give Eric Bischoff credit, they at least had the cruiserweight division to add a certain level of energy that I think the show would have been missing without it. They brought in all the luchadors from Mexico, you know, Rey Mysterio and Juventud and Psicosis, La Parca. I remember they brought in some guy named Blitzkrieg for a while who was kind of fun to watch. All of these different guys. And I bet half the people watching couldn't even tell you their name, but they liked watching them because it was usually 10, 12, 15 minutes of fun wrestling sandwiched by all the old guys, the NWO guys, coming out and doing their thing. So when Raw went to 3 hours, I thought, okay, maybe they'll come up with some other concepts, another division focusing on a particular type of wrestler or something, just to differentiate the rest of the show from that. You know, we'll have our segments with John Cena and Randy Orton and CM Punk, but what else are you going to give us that makes us look forward to watching Raw every week? And it's been over a year. They haven't done any of that. I think that's one of the big mistakes that they made. I, for one, would not mind seeing a minis division brought back. WWE has done it at different points in their existence. I remember back in the late 90s, around 97, they had a working agreement with AAA, I believe it was, and for a while we had some mini action on television, and even some of the pay-per-views. They kind of built that division around this guy called Max Mini, and then they had Mini Mankind and Mini Vader and Mini Goldust. Was it silly? Yeah, it was silly, but you know what? We see a lot of silly crap on Raw every week. So this would be no more or less silly than any of that other stuff. At least with this, they're entertaining. So imagine them building a minis division around El Torito as its star. You know, they brought back the minis on SmackDown about, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. That didn't last very long. But they had, Super Porky, I think it was. I don't remember any of the other guys. But they treated it like an afterthought. They lost interest and they got rid of it. Now that Raw's 3 hours, I would give some very serious thought to bringing something like that back. Or some sort of, you know, cruiserweight show or something like that. I mean, I know there's a lot of guys on the roster now who are generally smaller. Back in the day, guys were generally bigger. So having a cruiserweight division was a chance to showcase the smaller guys. Now there's more smaller guys anyway on TV. But there's so many small guys out there, and even that they have down in developmental. Like, if they bring up an Adrian Neville, let's just use him, okay? Pac, let's use him as an example. He's a great wrestler. He's doing well enough for himself down in NXT. He won the tag team titles a while back. He just wrestled Bo Dallas for the NXT title and lost. When it comes time to bring a guy like Adrian Neville up to the main roster, how far is somebody like him really going to go? You know, you could talk about, Daniel Bryan, he's so small, I can't take him seriously as a championship threat. Well, Adrian Neville's even smaller. And he's every bit as good of a wrestler as any of the guys on TV right now, and he can do some pretty incredible things in the ring. But what are they going to do with him when they bring him up? What's Vince McMahon when he takes a look at this guy and says, you know, why do we bring him up? Like, what are they going to do with him? Look at Xavier Woods. I'm not saying Xavier Woods is as good as Adrian Neville. They brought this guy up, and they're doing nothing with him. He's in a dance-off. He's involved in nothing of any consequence whatsoever. He was born a mid-carder from day one when they brought him up to the main roster. I guess, you know, they like the fact that he's going for his masters or something. So they cream themselves on commentary. Oh, look how smart this guy is. He's going for his masters or PhD or whatever it is. And that's why they brought him up. But I look at guys like a Neville. or Corey Graves, who maybe we'll see on television in the very near future. I don't have a lot of high hopes for these guys once they actually make it to the main roster. I think they're going to take one look at them, or Vince is going to take one look at them. Maybe they'll get a nice little burst when they first debut. They'll get a couple of big wins, and then they'll just fizzle out. Maybe it's not the worst idea in the world to bring back some sort of light heavyweight or cruiserweight division where these guys can be the center of attention. And then if they get over as big stars, then you can transition them from the cruiserweight division into, you know, some sort of main roster storyline that has some meaning to it. I mean, I hate to kind of pigeonhole these guys as just cruiserweights. I don't want to necessarily attach that label on them, and then it's hard to break out of that label. But I think they may have a better shot. They might actually have a chance that way, as opposed to them just not having anything for them to do. So, anyway, Big Show and Kane in the part of this double main event that they had here had a match with Booker T as the guest referee. What an ungodly boring match this was. Oh my God. There was a portion in the middle where Kane had Big Show down in a rest hold for what felt like forever, and it reminded me of that Big Show Bossman title match from Armageddon all those years ago where Show got knocked out and just laid on the floor on the outside for like 5 minutes straight, then suddenly won with his finish out of nowhere. That's what happened here. Kane went to chokeslam Booker, who escaped. He gave Kane a kick. He turned around right into a knockout punch, and Big Show got the pin. Why wouldn't Big Show just knock him out at the beginning of the match and save us the pain of having to sit through this? I don't know. For those who have asked, Kane is back to wearing the same outfit he wore after he unmasked the very first time. The only difference is that now he has some stubble on his head. So no, he's not wearing the mask. He doesn't really look any different. He's not wrestling in a suit and tie. It's just the old Kane outfit that he wore when he was Uncle Fester Kane all those years ago. After the match, Booker called out Michael Hayes, who came to the ring in his white suit. He tried to jump over the top rope into the ring, and he had a Roman Reigns moment. Had a little bit of a tumble. And instead of doing a spin-a-rooney, he did a moonwalk instead. That's his trademark move. Booker got Big Show to do something that mildly resembled a spin-a-rooney. I put the video of it up on my Facebook if you want to see it. And then Booker did one himself, and that was that. That brought us to the main event, John Cena, Randy Orton, for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. Orton is still coming out with both belts. I wonder if they'll keep that until WrestleMania. That's kind of what they did with Jericho. When Jericho won the Undisputed title at the end of 01, he walked around through WrestleMania with both belts. And it was after Triple H won that I think it might have been the very next night on Raw, or maybe a week later, they had Ric Flair come out and present him with a new belt. I don't think they're making a new belt for people who have asked. Maybe they will. Maybe they'll come up with some hybrid of the current belts, like melded together. I doubt it very seriously. I mean, this new belt, they're going to have this new belt for a long, long time. They paid a lot of money for this belt. They give replicas out to athletes whenever they win. You know, they gave it to David Ortiz when he won the World Series, and these people who just won, I think, Cy Young's in baseball. That image of that giant WWE logo on the title is already out there. They spent a lot of money on that belt. The belt hasn't even been out for a year. So I would be shocked if they did away with it and created a new belt. I figure maybe they'll have Orton or whoever carry both belts through WrestleMania, and then maybe starting the night after, whoever the champion is, they'll just come out with the WWE title. Cena got by far the biggest reaction of anybody on the show. I mean, there wasn't even a close second to compare him to. And maybe part of that was that Punk and Brian were in Chicago, but all the little kids freaked out. I mean, it was quite the sight to behold when this guy came out. You know, it did strike me watching this match. It was kind of weird that it's almost 2014 now, and the two main events that we had on the show were Big Show versus Kane and John Cena versus Randy Orton. And it's weird to me because when I think about the evolution of being a wrestling fan, you know, when I was younger, I would go to house shows and live events, and the guys that were most prominently featured were Hogan, Savage, DiBiase, Andre, even Honky Tonk Man, okay? There were a certain group of guys. And I think of only a few years later, in kind of the mid-90s, not even the late 90s, but like the middle portion of that decade, and who was on top? Who were the main guys? Well, you had Bret Hart. And you had Shawn Michaels, and you had the Bulldog, and Owen, and Luger, and Tatanka. Completely different crop of guys, right? A completely different crop of stars, some of whom were younger, And whereas Hogan was kind of the face of the company in that first era, here it was Bret Hart. And then only a few years later, during the Attitude Era, I would go to shows, and it was Austin, Rock, Foley, Taker, Triple H, New Age Outlaws. Again, a completely different crop of guys, and clearly Austin was the face of the company. And then you would go to house shows in the early 2000s, 02, 03, 04, and you had Triple H, you had Batista, you had Orton, and you had John Cena, and probably the Big Show also floating around in there, and Kane. Fast forward another 3, 4, 5 years, and who were the faces? Triple H, John Cena, the Big Show, Randy Orton. You could probably throw Edge in there, but a lot of the same guys. Fast forward to today, 2013, almost 2014. Who were the main faces? John Cena, Randy Orton, the Big Show, Kane. It's like at some point we hit this point in wrestling where there's not a lot of turnover anymore. It's a lot of the same faces. It's a lot of the same guys. It's like they just don't change. And it's great that John Cena still gets the mega superstar reaction when he comes out, but I don't know that it's such a good thing. I don't know what it says about WWE's ability or inability to create the next big star. It's like they've always been able to find that next big star or create that next big star, whether it was Hogan, Austin, Rock, Cena, and now they've hit this wall where they can't or they refuse to build around anybody but the same guys over and over again. And things really haven't evolved as quickly as they did back in the day. The match itself, I thought it was a great main event. I mean, I thought it was so much better than their match at TLC. I know they did the TLC match because, you know, it was the TLC pay-per-view. That's the risk you run when you have these gimmick shows. If it's Hell in a Cell, you have to have a Hell in a Cell match. And also because they needed a way to beat John Cena without actually beating him straight up by pinfall. But if that match was a straight match like this one was, would have been so much better. So much better at the pay-per-view. As good as that match was, and it was a good match, the ladder match, but it would have been so much better just having a normal one-on-one wrestling match. Tons of near falls. People were going nuts. They were out there doing their best Ring of Honor main event impersonation with all the near falls and people kicking out of finishers. And then came the trademark Randy Orton low blow for the DQ. What's funny to me is that when Justin Roberts announced John Cena as the winner by disqualification, everyone went crazy. You know, back in the day, the fans would react that way to the babyface being announced the winner by DQ or countout, even though maybe they didn't win the title. But people would still, I mean, they would cheer their heads off because the guy won the match. That was back when winning the match was actually still a big deal. But you don't really see that a lot these days. You know, people are more upset because they didn't get to see a title change or, oh, you know, it was a shitty DQ. But nope, these fans were happy as a pig in shit that John Cena won that match. And Randy Orton, I thought, was hilarious. Cena was still down, and after they announced him as the winner and people cheered, Orton just walks over to Cena, grabs his arm, and raises Cena's arm in the air like, yep, he's the winner. I just thought that was funny. Orton tried for a punt kick. Cena moved, nailed an attitude adjustment to send the crowd home happy. I'd put this match ahead of the cage match as the best match of the night, but I thought both of them were very good. Everything else was just kind of there. Just total filler. There have been far worse things I have spent $35 on. I'll put it that way. I had a good time. And I always, people ask me, you know, WWE's coming to my town, but it's just a house show. It's not a TV taping. Should I bother going? If you can get a ticket for $20 or $30, go. You're going to have a good time. Believe me. Even though you don't have to be on TV, it doesn't have to be a pay-per-view. Sometimes the things they do on these house shows, you know, they're allowed to kind of, you know, loosen up a little bit and try things that maybe eventually they will want to do on TV. That's what the live events are for. And they do some silly stuff, the Spin-a-Rooney contest or whatever. When you're there live, it's fun. So I would definitely say go if they come to your town. Don't be bothered if it's not on TV. It doesn't matter. On TV, you got to sit through commercial breaks and skits on, you know, the Titantron and all that BS. Sometimes it's not as much fun, quite frankly, as some of these shows.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the NXT Rewind main event match. I'm Tom Phillips, along with Byron Saxton and Tensai, and we're about to see William Regal go one-on-one with Antonio Cesaro. And Byron, this one's very personal for you.
This match is about redemption. And as far as I'm concerned, Antonio Cesaro is a glorified bully, and I hope he gets what he deserves tonight.
two similar styles in the ring. This is going to be a great match, possibly match of the year.
Let's head to the ring with the Fink, the Hall of Famer, Howard Finkel.
This contest is scheduled for one fall.
Oh, yes. The Fink was back this week. This was a year-in-review show, NXT was, hosted by Renee Young in an empty arena. They had lots of video packages, including one for what they called NXT's Match of the Year, the 2 out of 3 falls match between Antonio Cesaro and Sami Zayn, which I think was back in August. They also had a video highlighting all of the different NXT stars who have since moved on to the main roster, The Shield, the Wyatt family, guys like Big E Langston and Damian Sandow, who were already on TV at the start of the year, but they really came into their own in 2013. Interspersed between these videos, we had backstage promos with a bunch of guys like Big E Langston, who talked about how much his experience in NXT meant to his career. Bo Dallas, the NXT champion, talked about all of his Bo Leavers. Paige was backstage being interviewed by Devin Taylor and cut probably the best promo I've ever seen from her. She comes off to me as just being a natural heel. I think she can get over big as a babyface, which is exactly what's happened on NXT. But if you really watch the character of Paige, she comes off as a bratty little bitch. It's not like she's coming out there as this great babyface who's always, you know, playing to the crowd and all this stuff. The people have dictated that they like her and they cheer for her. But I think ultimately when she comes up to the main roster, it may be, at least initially, it may be as a heel. That may be the right role for her. Let the fans then, over time, kind of take to her and make her this anti-diva. That's her character on NXT. She's not a diva. She's the anti-diva. But I think bringing her up as a babyface is a mistake because she's just coming off as a natural heel. She may be the NXT star with the most main roster potential, I think, heading into 2014, if they actually do more with their Divas division. So she's one to watch out for. I see Paige, Emma, Summer Rae, and Bayley all being part of that revitalization. You know, you take a handful of current divas like AJ and Natalya. A lot of the others I really don't have any use for. But you take like two or three of those divas and pull them together with the four from NXT that I just mentioned, and you've really got something there. And here's where the match anatomy portion of this review kicks in, because even though this was a recap show in an empty arena and we saw a lot of video packages, they had taped a match, I guess, the previous week. That's probably why the Fink was there. Finkel was there the week before. They probably kept him around and taped this match. They only aired one match on NXT this week, and they spent part of the hour in between all the video packages and the other promos building up to this one match between Antonio Cesaro and William Regal. I loved everything about the build-up to the main event, from the pre-match promos backstage by both men to the announcers discussing the match beforehand, and Byron Saxton making no bones about the fact that he is biased. He is biased towards William Regal. They are friends. Regal is the one who saved him from Antonio Cesaro on NXT a couple of different times. You know, after what Cesaro has done to him, pushing him around and shoving him around and bullying him. So that aspect of it, to Howard Finkel doing the ring intros, which just made it feel like a big deal, to the match itself. And there's a reason why I tweeted that the match may not be everyone's cup of tea. Okay, that's the phrase I used when I tweeted after I watched the match. I thought it was a really good match, but I said that because I can see where some people would watch this and be bored. Okay, I can see that. And I like Cesaro's match with Sami Zayn more, but I really like this one too, just in a completely different way. It didn't have that overwhelming crowd reaction. The people weren't going nuts. It didn't have any high spots or, you know, flip dives out of the ring, or the insane finish that the Cesaro-Zayn match had. This was a wrestling match, through and through. And maybe it's just because we don't get to see them very often in WWE. I enjoyed this immensely for what it was. Everything about it, from the presentation beforehand to the promos, and the show of respect at the end with the handshake, which really, I felt, put Cesaro over. This was just fantastic stuff. Cesaro cut a promo earlier in the show. It was just him. There was nobody sticking a microphone in his face. They cut out the crowd noise, which is something I wish they would do more often on Raw and the pay-per-views when they have pre-match promos. You could still hear the crowd. You could still hear the crowd doing the what chant sometimes, and you know the wrestlers are reacting to the crowd. That's fine when you're out there in the ring, but I wish they would sometimes at least cut the crowd noise out and just have this one static image of whoever the interviewer is standing backstage with the wrestler and let the wrestler look dead in the camera instead of looking off camera. I don't know what the fuck these guys are looking at half the time. They're not even looking at the interviewer. It's not like they're looking at Josh Matthews or Renee. You know, on Raw, they got this one guy holding a camera, shaking it around, showing the wrestler, and they're looking off camera. I don't know if they're looking at cue cards or what the deal is with that. But that whole presentation, I'm not a fan of. But this was different. This was Cesaro backstage just looking in the camera, cutting a promo about his match with Regal. He says Regal is the only person he truly respected. And he was grateful. He was grateful that Regal helped get him a job in WWE, which may be a shoot. Regal has done that for a lot of some of the indie guys that have been signed. Regal usually goes to bat, whether it's Triple H or whoever. He goes to them and says, listen, you got to give this guy a look. You got to give this guy a shot. He's done that with the American Wolves. You know, Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards. And is it going to work? Are they going to sign them? I don't know. But Regal has gone to bat for them as well. The only reason they even got those tryout matches and Triple H agreed to give these guys a second look was because Regal went to bat for them. And he did it with Daniel Bryan. So I wouldn't be surprised if that aspect of it was a shoot. And Cesaro says, you know, in spite of all of that, the day has come where there can only be one of us in WWE and I'm going to put you down. I didn't even think, in all honesty, that it was that great of a promo. Cesaro's not known to be a strong promo guy. I've seen him do better. This was okay. This was not his best work. William Regal, though, that's a different story. They had a backstage promo with Regal. Surprise, surprise. It was great stuff. He talked about how he's nearing the end of his 30-year career in wrestling. The one thing above all else that he wanted so badly was to be the world champion. At least once, he wanted to be the world heavyweight champion. And he admitted that the only reason it never happened was because I've got a knack for getting myself into trouble. So again, something of a work shoot here where he's drawing upon some stuff that happened where he got suspended, if you remember. He got, actually, I think he's got two wellness policy suspensions on his record. But there was a period back around 2009 where Regal was one of the hottest stars in the company. And when I say hottest stars, I mean he had more heat. Like Vicky Guerrero has nuclear heat. Regal had a similar kind of heat back then. He was in this position as the commissioner, I believe, at the time. He would do that gimmick where when the fans would boo him and wouldn't shut up and let him speak, he would have the lights in the arena turned off. And he was all over television every single week. He was in a very prominent role. That was the one time in that man's career where I honestly thought if there was ever a shot that this guy could hold a world title, that was it. He had so much heat built up as a heel, and you still had the two world titles that, not the WWE title, but I could see them giving him a brief run with the world title. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that that could have happened. He could have been a world champion. I mean, you know, they considered giving Jerry Lawler the WWE championship when he feuded with Miz. In early 2011, they had a couple of matches together. The second match, I think it was the Elimination Chamber match that they had for the title. It was just one-on-one, Miz and Lawler, after they had their TLC match on Raw. That was awesome. There was thought at the time, you know, they thought very seriously. Vince McMahon considered putting the title on Lawler, which I think would have been fine, provided that Miz won the belt back the next night. You're not going to have Lawler win the title and defend it at WrestleMania. But I would not have had a problem, even though Lawler was almost 60 years old at that point. He was so over. And the story they were telling of, you know, the young heel against the older veteran, if Lawler would have gotten a feel-good win at the Chamber and won the title and then dropped it back to Miz the next night, that would have been fine. And they actually considered it. So, you know what? If they gave serious consideration to putting the title on Jerry the King Lawler at age 59 or whatever he was at the time, believe me, it's not out of the realm of possibility or believability that they could have given William Regal a short run with the world title back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And so in this promo, he's kind of hearkening back to that and saying, I got nobody to blame but myself. I fucked up on that one. And he did. He got busted and he got suspended. So he was off television. He lost his commissioner's post. I think it was actually Mr. Anderson, Ken Kennedy, who beat him in a match. And it was very thrown together at the last minute because they had to get Regal off TV. I think the next day they announced his suspension. And they really haven't had the same level of trust in him ever since. He's lucky they didn't just cut ties and fire him altogether. I'm sure it's his friendship with Triple H is the reason why he still has a job. But he'll never be in that position again. He'll never be prominently featured on TV. He sure as hell won't ever be considered for a world title run. And he talked about that here and said it bothers him. He's got nobody to blame but himself. And he said, this match tonight, you know, the outcome is basically a foregone conclusion. I'm going to get my ass kicked. It's kind of like what CM Punk did before that handicap match against The Shield at TLC, where he came on Raw and said, look, I know I'm going to get my ass beat. I know I don't stand a chance, but I'm going to take down as many of the Shield guys as I can in the process, even though Punk went on and won the match anyway. But Regal said here, look, outside of a miracle, I know I'm going down, but I'm going to compete with every little bit of fire I got left in me. And it was great. I mean, these are the kind of promos I wish we would see more of before some big, you know, pay-per-view matches where they would go backstage and just let the guy cut a promo and talk about why this match means so much to him. Why should we care about this main event? We get main events every month. What makes this match so special? This was a freaking NXT match on a recap show on Hulu. At least in this country. I know it airs on TV in other countries. But that's all this match was. And yet, they did a better job of making me care more about this match than most matches I see on Raw every single week. There's no reason they can't apply that same formula to their main shows. They could do that very easily if they wanted to. And the thing I also really liked about this promo, Regal put his opponent over. He had nothing but complimentary things to say about Antonio Cesaro. He didn't say Cesaro was overrated or that he sucked or anything like that. Quite the contrary. And as a result of building up his opponent, it made the match feel that much more special. There have been a number of WWE guys, okay, main eventers, including one big-name star, and I won't mention any names, who made a habit of doing just the opposite when it came to talking about his opponents on promos. And for the life of me, I don't know why you would do that. Even if it was true, if you tell the audience that your opponent is no good and they suck, then why the hell would they ever want to see that match? I mean, it's one thing if you're a heel and you want to, you know, bully the guy and say, oh, you know, you got a big nose, you got funny hair, or there's no way you can beat me. But there were guys, including, you know, the one guy I'm thinking of, who would go out there and would cut these promos that basically said, listen, you're good, but you're really, you don't deserve to be here. You're not worthy of being here. You suck. And then they would go on to actually beat them, thereby proving that they were right. And I never understood that. I never understood who that benefited other than that person. But that was one other aspect of this promo that I really enjoyed. I don't know that a match like this would ever work on Raw. I think they would give, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to these guys, and there's just no way to tell a story like these guys told here in just 3 or 4 minutes. You know, it's just not possible. I also think in front of a Raw crowd, this match probably would have died a death. And that's not an indictment on Cesaro or Regal. It's just, you know, those fans have not been conditioned to seeing a match like this. In this setting, it was perfect in this NXT arena. You know, the fans even started a This Is Wrestling chant at one point. I haven't heard a This Is Wrestling chant since the last Ring of Honor show I went to, which I don't even remember when that was, probably earlier this year. But the match was, it was a clinic. It was a clinic in wrestling psychology, you know, working different body parts. First, Cesaro had Regal in a wrist lock, right? The first, like, 5 minutes of the match is just Regal trying to fight his way out of a wrist lock, which sounds like the most boring thing in the world, but yet you watch this, and it wasn't. It was just like they have you enthralled, and you're watching, and you're wondering, okay, how's this guy going to get out of this, and what's the next move going to be? And you know, Regal, there's at least 3 different kip-ups that this guy does, which was very impressive. And I understand that Regal is holding on to Cesaro for some support. But still, for a guy at his age, and Regal is bigger than he used to be, he's put on some weight. Still very impressive to see him do 3 or 4 different kip-ups during this match. Cesaro then decides to target Regal's knee after Regal fights his way out. And Regal, I think, had a knee brace or a sleeve. Not those big knee braces like Austin had. It's some kind of like sleeve on his knee. And he starts ripping the sleeve off and, you know, attacking the knee to try to cause further damage. And, you know, he did this one move, Cesaro did. I don't even know how to describe it, really, where he took Regal's injured leg and he wrapped it kind of around his neck and stood up. And Regal was just kind of hanging there. He almost like lifted Regal up by his leg, which was draped over his own neck. And I'm sure there must be a name for this thing, but it looked brutal. It looked painful. So he was just torturing this guy. And Regal fights back. He nails Cesaro later on in the bicep. after Cesaro tried for a neutralizer. He hit him right in the bicep. So, you know, it made sense that he would go after the arm because he's trying to avoid this guy's finishing move. Then he goes after the other arm to the point where now Cesaro can't even use both arms. He's selling like they're both hurt. He can't even throw a punch. I don't think he threw one punch for the rest of the match, for the remaining minutes of the match. Not one punch did this guy throw because he was selling the effects of these punches on his arms. So instead, he had to resort to other moves. So he starts doing kicks. He's doing some headbutts. Finally, let's fast forward to the end of the match here. Cesaro did a double stomp. Okay, Regal was down on the mat, and he did a double stomp right on top of Regal's head. This looked awful. And I don't say awful in that it looked bad. It looked brutal. It's like one of those moves where if I was in the same position, I'd think twice before I agreed to take a move like that. And I said that, too, back, you know, when I would see... who was the guy in TNA who would do the... Sanjay Dutt, I think, would do, like, the double stomp off the top rope. Maybe Caval also used to do it, you know, low-key. But I know Sanjay Dutt did it in TNA, and I'm sure he does it. It's very safe. He's not killing the other dude. But I can't help but watch that on TV and just think, you know what? If I was ever the other guy in that ring, there's no way I would ever agree to take a move like that because it just looks brutal. So he did the double stomp to Regal's head. Regal is out. I mean, he is selling this like he is just dead as a doornail. And Cesaro's trying to pick him up now to finish him off, but we start to see some remorse in the guy's face for his actions. He's not, you know, he's not feeling too good about this. He sees Regal is dead, and he starts to actually feel some remorse. And Regal starts fighting back, and as soon as Regal tries to fight back, Cesaro just loses. All any remorse he may have had goes right out the window. He's like, fuck this, I'm going to finish this guy off now. And he does. He finishes him off with the neutralizer. 1, 2, 3. And they showed a whole series of replays. We come back. We see referees are helping Regal out of the ring, up the aisle. And Cesaro comes up from behind. And you figure, okay, he's going to attack him. But instead of attacking him, he waits. And when Regal turns around, and now they're face-to-face in the aisleway, Cesaro extends his hand out of respect. And Regal thinks about it for a few seconds, and then he shakes Cesaro's hand in the ultimate show of respect. And they go off the air. And that's how the show ended, with a show of respect between these two guys when the match was over. And I don't know if they were doing that maybe to kind of test the waters for a future Cesaro babyface turn. We've heard rumors of this for a few months now, but I think WWE likes how the Real Americans Act has gotten over, and Triple H is so gaga over tag teams now. Maybe they were just hesitant to break them up, so they delayed it. I think it's inevitable that Cesaro is going to break away and go babyface at some point. And this almost looked like maybe they were testing the waters for it. Every time Cesaro goes to NXT, it's worth noting, he gets a huge babyface reaction. And I give William Regal a lot of credit. And whoever, you know, booked the match, whoever was doing the booking now for the show, it was kind of genius because they did it in such a way where you felt such sympathy for this guy, Regal, and people were so behind him that for the first time that I can remember in a long time, Cesaro wrestled the match on NXT and by and large did not get cheered by the crowd. The crowd was booing him. They wanted Regal to win. So it was effective in that way. But more often than not, when Cesaro was on the show, people are into him. They're cheering him. They're doing the We the People chant very loudly because they love him. In the ring, he's a great wrestler, and they appreciate that down there. So this was a very enjoyable episode. It's probably the most fun I've had watching a recap show. You know, I normally watch these things, and it's like, oh, God, more video packages. But the way they did this, they highlighted the important people from the year that have really come into their own and showed footage of some people to look out for next year, like Mojo Rawley and some of the other people they featured, you know, Alexander Rusev, who I do think is going to be on the main roster sooner rather than later. So, again, he's a name to watch out for. But the main event was just, it was awesome. It was awesome in a different way than maybe some other matches would be. But when you really break it down, every aspect of what they did here, again, from the promos to the announcing to the story they told, the psychology in the match, everything here, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if you know, they did this and somebody like Regal would hope that other guys who are working down in NXT will take footage of this. They'll find the tape or the DVD of this and they'll use this as a way to study and to learn from it. I think probably a lot of guys who are down there can learn a lot of things by watching this match. I'm sure Regal helps a lot of the guys down there anyway. But this was just great stuff. So if you've got an hour, not even an hour, I mean, the show's probably a little less. But if you've got an hour of time to spare, go out of your way. At least watch, you know, the main event. If you want to fast forward through some of the video packages, that's fine. But just watch the promos and watch everything that sets up the main event here and the match itself. It's not the match of the year or anything like that. I'm not going to heap that much praise on it, but it was just very, very enjoyable. It was very old school, and I very much enjoyed it for what it was, and I think you will too. I was at the MSG House show on Thursday night, so I didn't catch Impact until yesterday, but I watched the whole show. I thought the show was pretty boring this week. I enjoyed Impact the week before. This was a big step down. The main angle was Jeff Hardy quitting TNA after the main event. The main event was Jeff Hardy and Sting in a 4-on-2 handicap match against EC3, Rockstar Spud, and the Bromans. So Dixie Carter stacking the deck against the babyfaces here. And they lost. Sting actually got rolled up by EC3 and pinned. So they continue to use Sting to help put over the younger guys, which I guess if he sticks around in TNA, that'll be his role. That probably should be his role. I just think, again, there's still some money to be made in Sting, but that's his decision to make at this point. So they lose the match. Hardy gets on the microphone afterwards and says he can't stand Dixie Carter's power trip anymore. He doesn't have the heart and the fire and the passion to fight against it. And until things change in TNA, he's gone. He's quitting. He's leaving. This is the angle that I addressed a few weeks ago after rumors started spreading that Hardy was going to go back to WWE. He's not. He has a criminal record, and he is not allowed to travel to the UK for their tour next month. So this is just a way to write him out of storylines until they get back from the tour. So I'm sure in February, maybe even March, maybe they hold him out a little bit longer. But Jeff Hardy will be back. I think at the end of this promo, I wrote down here, he said, "Until the sun shines again on this dark kingdom," Hardy said, in reference to TNA. If that's what he's waiting for, he may be off TV a lot longer than we all think. That kingdom has been dark for a while. I don't see any signs of light anytime soon. So that was the big angle. You know, after a while, you just get desensitized to this kind of stuff. You know, another fake, phony retirement here. I mean, how many of these have we seen? Actually, I guess the Hulk Hogan one, as it turned out, was maybe the most legit of them all. He walked out on Dixie with her humping his leg, and he ain't coming back. But by and large, you know, they've done so many of these types of angles where it's just like, okay, sure, you know. See you in a few weeks, that kind of thing. They had these Rise of Magnus vignettes throughout the show. Magnus was not on the show itself. They claimed he was, I guess, back in England. But they had these sit-down interviews with him that, you know, he talked about the beginning of his career when he came out as the Brutus Magnus character. He looked completely ridiculous, by the way. He kind of reminded me of when Ron Simmons made his debut in WWF as Farouk, and he had the gladiator helmet on. Thankfully, that didn't last very long, the tinfoil hat. So they had footage of him earlier in his career and, you know, teaming with Samoa Joe and going through the Bound for Glory series right up until the heel turn where he aligned with Dixie the week before. Again, I think Magnus has a certain presence about him. He's very well-spoken. He's very articulate. He doesn't come off as being nervous or timid or anything like that. As a wrestler, he's not that great. He's okay. Is he ready to be a world champion? Of course. Is Magnus really a world champion? Of course not. But I don't mind them putting the title on him because, A, it doesn't mean anything anyway, and B, you know, at least they're giving somebody different a shot. It's not the same old people. You know, this group they're pushing with him and Ethan Carter and Rockstar, even the Bromans. The Bromans are not a main event level, you know, gimmick. If they're going to start portraying them as main eventers, that's not a good idea, because it's kind of like Zack Ryder's gimmick. Zack Ryder's gimmick is not that of a main eventer. If WWE pushed him harder than they did, he only would have gotten so far anyway. Some guys are just not made for the main event. Some characters are just not made for the main event. Hopefully this was just a one-week thing and we don't have to see the Bromans in the main event every week. But I don't mind them putting the focus on guys like Magnus and Spud and EC3. You know, if they're going to fail, they're going to fail. And maybe they won't fail. Maybe they'll do well. But at least it's somebody different. At least it's a younger guy for a change, and it's not the same old shit. So at least I can appreciate that. They had a segment on here with Bully Ray, who's doing this, I don't know, he's doing this emo gimmick where he's down in the dumps. He doesn't speak a whole lot. He comes out sunglasses and a hoodie. Brooke Tessmacher was complaining about how he wouldn't return her calls or her emails or her texts. Is she really sending him emails? Seems kind of odd to me, but This was fine until the cheesy music kicked in. If you saw this segment, you know exactly what I'm talking about. They came out to the ring. Brooke was basically like, I'm finished with you. I'm done. She went to leave. Bully grabbed her arm and said, you're done when I say you're done. You're done when I'm done using you. And he cut this heel promo on her and called her ugly and said, I had certain uses for you. And sometimes when we were together, I would close my eyes and I would picture the other Brooke instead of you, which is comical to me that anybody would even consider doing that. But then they played this really cheesy background dramatic music. You know, WWE did a similar thing with Kane a few years ago when he was on TV, when he was the world champion. He used to come out on SmackDown and do these soliloquies every single week. It sucked then, and it sucks now. Just get rid of the stupid background music. It's so dumb. It is so dumb. I mean, you could have had a perfectly fine segment without the stupid music in the background. Just don't play the music. It's so dumb. Joseph Park beat Bad Influence in a Monsters Ball match, which saw the return of Abyss. Not in the Abyss costume, but he transformed into Abyss, maybe for good, because when the match was over, unlike in the past, he didn't snap out of his little trance. You know, the gimmick is that he blacks out. And then he becomes Joseph Park again, and he's like, what happened? What happened? They didn't do that this time. He actually walked out, blood all over him, holding the barbed wire board, Janice, and he walked out. So I don't know if that's it for Joe Park. I know he's still doing the Joe Park character on the house shows this weekend, so my guess is we haven't seen the last of the character on TV, but I think we're about to, if we haven't already. I think Joe Park is not long for this world. It seems to be reaching its conclusion. And again, it makes me very sad. I like the Joe Park character. I got a soft spot for the guy. And would like to see them continue it on in some form or fashion. Maybe it becomes a live event gimmick. Maybe when they go to the live events, they can have Joseph Park make special appearances. He can be TNA's... TNA can retain his services as their official counsel. He could do pro bono work for them since they can't afford to pay him. That was Impact. That was pretty much all the important stuff that happened. Everything else was just kind of there. I know they had a knockouts match. They're just in this kind of holding pattern right now. Plus, a lot of their TV is in the can. So even through the next 2 or 3 weeks, they've got television taped. By the time it airs, that TV will have been taped, I mean, in some cases, maybe 6 months earlier. You know, you could get away with that back in the day when, you know, WWE would tape a Saturday night's main event. It wouldn't air for another month. You didn't have the internet back then. Now it's just, it just feels so old and stale, and there's just not a whole lot going on. And the angles they're doing, they're just recycling a lot of the same angles we've seen a million times before, both in TNA and in WWE. And it's just, there's nothing original, there's nothing overly exciting about anything that's happening in TNA right now. So, again, why not give somebody like Magnus a shot? You're in this lame duck dead kind of period right now. The one thing you can at least try to do is get over some new faces and get over some new names. I'm still wondering where Sam Shaw is. They got me mildly interested in this new character he was portraying that did those vignettes with Christy Hemme. Now, all of a sudden, I haven't seen him on TV in like 3 weeks. You know, a guy like Kenny King, what the hell happened to him? I enjoyed Kenny King. He hasn't been on TV in 2 months. This is the problem in TNA. If you're going to put these guys on TV, you can't put them on TV and then take them away and not bring them back for another 3 months. If you're going to put somebody on TV, build something around them. Build their character up. Don't put them on TV and then pull them and then bring them back 3 months later and expect us to give a shit, because we won't. AJ Styles. We have an update on AJ Styles, and it's kind of a big one. Ring of Honor announced that AJ Styles has signed to wrestle Roderick Strong at their January 4th event at the Nashville Fairgrounds, right in TNA's backyard. That's an interesting little twist there. Kind of a little FU, almost, to TNA. He's coming back to Nashville, but it's for another promotion. And it's going to be AJ's first match in Ring of Honor in almost 8 years. And what I find most interesting about this whole thing is that it's a television taping. And this match with him and Roderick Strong is going to air on ROH TV on February 1st. As a general rule, TNA does not allow any of its talent to wrestle on indie shows where their matches are going to appear either on TV or on DVD. It's just not allowed. It's prohibited. And the promoters know this. So this is the first such booking that AJ has accepted that breaks that rule. And I mean, I suppose it's possible they're trying very, very hard to work the internet by allowing him to wrestle on TV, but I would think Ring of Honor would want some assurances that that is not the case. I cannot see Ring of Honor being too happy about being worked, and I don't think AJ Styles would do that to them. I'm guessing AJ is on the up and up with them and said, listen, I got nothing with Ring of Honor, with TNA, and so let me come in and you know, work a shot for you guys. Mike Johnson of PW Insider was the first to report that negotiations between Styles and TNA have collapsed, and it now looks very unlikely that he's going to be back anytime soon. That doesn't mean that he and TNA can't restart talks, and in a couple of months he can't come back. It's not like a bridge has been burned that he's never, ever going to go back. But I know there were some reports that popped up, and that's why I didn't talk about them last week, that, well, AJ's already signed, it's a done deal, he's coming back. TNA wants him back. TNA was hoping that he would be back at one of their shows later in January. I think they have a show over in Glasgow, because they're going to be overseas on their UK tour. They had penciled him in to come back on that show, and right now it doesn't look like that's going to happen. There was no deal done. I don't know from TNA's perspective if they thought it was, but there was never any new contract signed or anything like that. They were still engaged in talks, and it makes me wonder if this is all legit and this is all on the up and up and negotiations really did break down. I mean, what the hell is going on in TNA? What is so difficult about closing the deal and just signing this guy? This should be a no-brainer. This shouldn't even be up for debate. This guy should have been locked under contract months ago. And now it looks like they're negotiating, things are going well, then talks collapse. Why would the talks collapse? Unless AJ Styles is making some kind of outrageous demand. And according to him, he's not. He did an interview a few weeks ago and said, I'm not making any outrageous demands here. In fact, I'm not even asking for more money. He just wanted the same deal. And talks break down. And it just makes you wonder how bad things must be behind the scenes for TNA that they can't even close the deal with this guy. What the hell is going on there? But hey, Dixie says they're cash flow positive, so everything must be all hunky-dory, I guess, in Dixieland. We just have to take her word for it. The evidence here would suggest otherwise. But like I said before, if this is all legit, it's just a huge embarrassment for TNA. After building everything around this AJ Styles storyline, to lose the guy for real, if that really is what's happening here. And especially, he's going to still be appearing on at least one episode of Impact after his Ring of Honor date. So when he wrestles at Ring of Honor on January 4th, I mean, it won't air on TV for another month, but he's going to wrestle for them on the 4th. He's got at least one television appearance left on Impact. I'm not going to spoil what happens, but he is going to be back on television very soon, because those shows are already taped and in the can. And that's embarrassing. If I'm TNA, I am embarrassed by this whole situation, because it never should have gotten to this point in the first place. And then there's Jeff Jarrett. This was the other big story, which I think could turn out to be a lot bigger than any of us ever imagined. Right now, we don't have a lot in the way of details, but Jeff Jarrett went on Twitter Monday morning at the beginning of the week, and he announced that on December 22nd, which was a week ago, so this would be last Sunday, he says, I officially resigned from TNA Entertainment. Thanks to everyone involved for all the fantastic memories. TNA put an official statement out later that day saying that it had accepted Jeff Jarrett's resignation from the company effective January 6th, 2014. And Dixie Carter said, on behalf of TNA, we would like to thank Jeff for his contributions. We wish him the very best and look forward to his continued participation as an investor in TNA Wrestling. Which is an interesting line for her to put in there. It is believed that Jarrett signed a non-disclosure agreement. He can't really say much right now. That's why he hasn't said anything since he posted that tweet. It's funny, you know, Jeff Jarrett has not been on TNA television in a couple of years. He has been off television for a long time, but he has been still very heavily involved with forging relationships with other promotions like AAA. They've had a working agreement with them. Great Muda's Wrestle 1 promotion in Japan. Both promotions where AJ Styles went and wrestled when they were still doing the angle, and he went and he did matches there. A lot of that, you know, it had to do with these working agreements that Jeff Jarrett helped forge with these promotions. And he was involved in that whole Ring Ka King thing over in India, which I think lasted one season, and then you know, Ring Ka King is no more. But Jarrett was pretty deeply involved in a lot of different affairs still to this day in TNA. We just didn't see much of him. He had only recently resurfaced behind the scenes as an agent. So he was working with a lot of the wrestlers, producing their matches and stuff, and people were, I guess, raving about the work he was doing. And it almost looked like ever since Bischoff and Hogan went away, Jarrett suddenly resurfaced behind the scenes. Maybe he was gaining more power. Maybe he was gaining more influence again. Because when those guys went away, all of a sudden you heard, oh, Jeff Jarrett popped up backstage. And the wrestlers were very surprised because they haven't seen Jarrett in a long time. And now all of a sudden he started popping up. And to give some background here for those who don't know, Jarrett lost power, I want to say it was probably like 3 or 4 years ago. Jarrett was always a big power broker. I mean, he helped found the company with his dad. He was one of the founders of TNA. And he had creative power behind the scenes. And then there was an incident where Dixie Carter confronted him. There were some rumors that he was having a relationship with Karen Angle, who I think was going through a split with Kurt at the time, but maybe they weren't officially divorced. And it was kind of a sore spot. Maybe I don't think Kurt was aware of what was going on. And Jarrett denied it. He said, no, I'm not. That's false. And in the end, it actually turned out to be true. And I guess Dixie was bothered that Jeff would lie to her. So he got kicked off the creative team. And he lost a lot of his power in that company. So he was gone for a while. He came back. Him and Karen became a very entertaining duo on television. This was during a period where I wasn't watching TNA every single week like I am now. But I saw enough of them to think, okay, yeah, they're pretty entertaining together as these on-screen characters. And then Jarrett went and he wrestled in AAA. He was wrestling down in Mexico. Him and Karen went down there to work. Again, that was part of the working relationship between the two companies. And actually, he came back and they did an angle on TNA television with him and Kurt Angle. So even though Kurt was not happy about the situation with his wife, it's wrestling. So you take a real-life situation and you turn it into a storyline, and those two guys made up and they worked together. And Kurt Angle and Jeff Jarrett had some of the best matches in TNA. I never looked at Jeff Jarrett as being this fantastic wrestler. I've always found him to be kind of dull, to be honest with you. He has his moments. I'm not the biggest Jeff Jarrett fan in the world. But the matches with him and Kurt were great stuff, and they had this great blood feud on television for a while. And so, again, he started popping up again in recent months behind the scenes. There was a report in the Observer, the Wrestling Observer this week, that said something major was expected to go down in TNA before the end of the year, and it didn't. And there had been rumors about TNA being up for sale. And I know there were a lot of people who did videos and stuff, other podcasts and shows who talked about the same thing. And in some cases, they were, completely appalled that these stories were even popping up. Oh, TNA's not for sale, blah, 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 all this stuff. The reality is, TNA may not have had a for sale sign outside their offices, but there were enough reports out there from legitimate sources where, where there's smoke, there's fire. There was a name that, again, in the Observer, for example, they didn't mention what the name was, but supposedly there was a potential celebrity investor that had been talked about, and then the deal fell through. Well, it turns out that celebrity investor was Toby Keith, who is a country music star. He has done very well for himself. Outside of that, he's had other business, ventures and whatnot. Forbes tabbed him at being worth upwards of $500 million. So he's a pretty successful guy and a wrestling fan. And according to these reports, he was the lead guy in the group that was looking to purchase TNA. And Jeff Jarrett was expected then to be back in some position of power in the company had that sale gone through because he's got a friendship with Toby Keith. So Jarrett quitting TNA would seem to indicate that whatever was going to potentially happen there isn't happening now, but it makes me wonder, what the hell is Jeff Jarrett going to do? Because Jeff Jarrett, he's not an old man. He's not an old guy. He's not going to retire. He's not going to, ride off into the sunset. Is he going to be involved with another wrestling promotion? Is he going to go work for AAA, where he was working for a while? I don't know that I see Jeff Jarrett going full-time down to Mexico. I have a tough time seeing that. He's not going back to WWE. And if I'm WWE, I don't see the value in even bringing the guy back. Vince McMahon has made peace with a lot of guys that's burned bridges with him over the years. Hogan, Brett. But he did so because it was a good business move. Bringing Hulk Hogan back, bringing Bret Hart back after Montreal all those years ago, it was good for business. He did what was right for business. What is the good business move in bringing Jeff Jarrett back to WWE? He was never a huge star there. Jeff Jarrett is not a draw. He was never a draw. And given how he left the company, I think the only way Vince would take him back and put him back on TV in any sort of role would be if Jarrett was an actual star. And he wasn't. So I see no reason for WWE to bring him back. I see no reason for Vince McMahon to want to work with this guy again. I'm not saying that years down the road they run out of people and want to put him in the Hall of Fame, but I just don't see that happening. So take WWE off the table. That's not going to happen. What does he do? Does he start another wrestling company? Why would he do that? After all the years starting TNA, struggling with TNA, the financial problems, seeing what they went through with that company over all these years, and credit to TNA, the fact they're still even alive today is a miracle. They actually do. They deserve credit for that. Because they probably should have been dead a long time ago, but somehow they have managed to keep the company going, barely maybe, but TNA, 11 or 12 years later, is still alive. But there's been a lot of problems, and you would think that Jarrett would, of all people, be aware of this. Starting a wrestling company from scratch at a time when wrestling really isn't that hot, I mean, I don't really know how much sense that makes, unless if Toby Keith is ready to start his own wrestling company and is going to pump $100 million into it and put Jeff Jarrett in charge, then why not, you know? Go for it. I don't know that that's going to happen, but if it doesn't, I just have a hard time seeing where Jarrett falls, unless Jarrett's going to do something completely unrelated to pro wrestling and go start a venture doing something else. I don't know what that would be. My guess is that not long after the new year, we're going to find out. Jarrett will make some kind of announcement, and we'll find out what his next move is. But it's still a pretty shocking thing that the founder of this company, the one guy who you always expected to be part of TNA in some way, and I guess he's still an investor, according to what Dixie said, although for how much longer, who knows. But the fact that this guy would just quit, it wasn't even like he was fired. He would just, on his own, say, you know what, I'm done. I resign. I want nothing to do with this anymore. I'm out. Is kind of shocking. It really is. And it's yet another sign that, boy, things must be real rough, even rougher than they would let on, when they can't sign AJ Styles and they can't even keep Jeff Jarrett around, the guy who founded the company. He basically gives up and says, I'm done. Very, very curious to see where he lands and what his next move is. And I imagine that in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll probably know a lot more about that. Let's dive into the mailbag here. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. That includes audio questions if you want to send them in MP3 format, preferably no more than 30 seconds or so. And with every email you send, please include your name and where you are from. Nick from Atlanta, what do you think of the reports that Bray Wyatt will wrestle John Cena in the WrestleMania main event? Yeah, I saw that. It was in this week's Observer. I don't know if this was reported anywhere else. That surprised me. I did not see that one coming. When you think of all the rumored matches for WrestleMania, Punk versus Triple H, Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, now possibly Orton and Batista, there's rumors of that. John Cena is the odd man out. So is Daniel Bryan, I guess, unless he wins the Rumble and gets the title shot. Otherwise, I guess we're not getting the payoff to that storyline. So what do you do with John Cena? It sounds like they'd love to do something with him and Hulk Hogan, maybe, but Hogan can't wrestle. I just don't see it. Who would clear him? How would that man pass a physical? He could barely move. If doctors won't clear Edge to compete because he could end up paralyzed, I can't imagine they would allow Hulk Hogan to wrestle a match. And Cena's headline the past three WrestleManias, 27, 28, and 29. He's their number one guy. So I get that they want him to be in the main event again. I'm just not sold on Bray Wyatt in that spot yet. I think it's way too early. I mean, maybe they can convince me otherwise between now and then. I guess that depends on what they do with the Royal Rumble and the shows afterward. I like the idea of putting somebody new in there against John Cena instead of the same old faces. They did that with The Miz at WrestleMania 27. That match sucked. But Miz was not the right guy. Miz should never have been in a WrestleMania main event. Bray Wyatt, I could see Bray Wyatt in a WrestleMania main event one day. I mean, it's a tough sell right now. I could tell you that much. I don't see him in a WrestleMania main event in the next year or two. But, you know, Wyatt Wyatt can mean more than Miz did. I'm more intrigued by his character. I just don't buy him in that position, especially if that's the last match on the card. I mean, what do you guys think would be the question I would pose to you? Is there any scenario you can envision that would make you buy into a John Cena Bray Wyatt WrestleMania main event next year? Or maybe you already do. Maybe there's a lot of Bray Wyatt fans out there who absolutely can see him in the WrestleMania main event. If not, what would they have to do to get you excited for that match? I'd have to give that one some thought as far as, again, like I said, it depends what they do. They could win me over. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, if you're just completely turned off by the idea, but what would they have to do to get you excited in that match if that's the match we see? My gut tells me that may be the plan right now. I do believe that that's the plan right now. I'm sure that there's some truth to that, but there's a lot of time between now and WrestleMania. I don't see that match happening. I just don't. But anything's possible. Seth, in Indianapolis, I had Bray Wyatt, Luke Harper, Fandango, and Wade Barrett in my restaurant here in Indianapolis. Bray was the most down-to-earth of the group. The thing that stuck out to me was I asked Fandango about guys like him and Dolph Ziggler getting pushes and then losing them because of injury. He said, "You can't get hurt. Do you think this will cause wrestlers to work even though they know they may be seriously injured? Seems like a hell of a way to lose talent if that's the message they are pushing." And Seth included a photo with his email of all the guys with him in the restaurant. So very cool. Very cool stuff. I especially like Fandango's doggy bag here in the picture. Unfortunately, to go back to your point, that's always been the case in wrestling. You get hurt, and unless you're a tippy-top guy, you know, Triple H tore his quad and came back and won the title at WrestleMania the year after. Steve Austin was out 10 months after neck surgery, came back, same thing. Unless you're one of those guys, if you take time off, you're going to lose your spot. So I'm not surprised that Fandango would say that. I mean, look what happened to him. Look at Dolph. Dolph's big mouth is probably what got him into more trouble than anything else, but he got hurt. He was out for several weeks. And it's like they just lost interest and they decided to change directions. I see Wade Barrett in your photo as well. Wade's another one. He suffered that gruesome elbow injury last year. In that battle royal when he got dumped out, there had been rumors at the time of him maybe winning a Money in the Bank briefcase that summer. And if he would have won the briefcase, I have no doubt that it would have been WWE, not TNA, putting a press release out or putting some sort of announcement out about how, you know, Wade Barrett is the first British-born world heavyweight champion in a major promotion in however many years, 100 years or whatever it is. I have no doubt if Barrett would have won a Money in the Bank briefcase, he would have cashed in. He would have become a world champion by now. But he was gone for a while, came back, and yes, he won the Intercontinental title, but they did nothing with him. He just lost every match anyway. And then look at him now. They still don't know what to do with this guy. His push was never the same after that injury. And it wasn't like he was known for being injury prone or anything. It was a freak accident. Bray Wyatt suffered a thigh injury recently. Pretty bad. I think it was like a deep, maybe it was a calf injury, like a calf bruise or something. But he couldn't wrestle for a while. But with his character, he didn't have to miss any TV time. He was still out there in his rocking chair every week. So, of course, you're going to have guys, I'm sure, hiding some nagging injuries. Some injuries you can't hide. If somebody tears a muscle or something, it's pretty hard to hide that. But I'm sure they'll think twice before complaining about a minor injury for fear of losing their spot. The problem is, what happens when that minor injury turns into a major one? Brian in Cottonwood, Arizona, do you think it's time for WWE to cut bait on Brock Lesnar and save themselves the headaches and money? His part-time status doesn't really do anything positive for the company. He doesn't attract pay-per-view buys. Unless they can get him to work more dates in 2014 and have him put over rising talent in the company, I really see no point in him continuing in WWE. I think it's time we moved on from Brock Lesnar and his part-time status. Well, I don't think I can disagree with you more. Would I like to see Brock on television more? Of course I would. But if you have a guy like Brock Lesnar, he's a special guy, he's a special talent, and you can sign him to a contract to exclusively work for you and get a couple of pay-per-view dates out of him, then you're a fool to not sign him to a contract. Brock is a star. When Brock walks out there, people notice. People stop whatever they're doing, and they pay attention. And maybe he's not the pay-per-view draw he was when he was in UFC. Maybe him being on SummerSlam last year didn't mean anything to the buy rate. But if promoted properly, Brock is money. You have Brock under contract, you take advantage of that. And you put him in there with your biggest stars, Brock and Undertaker, Brock and Cena. You know, there's a lot of big money matches they could still do with Brock Lesnar to just say, oh, well, Brock's not on television every week, and so therefore he's useless, and he's not putting over younger guys. Brock Lesnar is not there to put over younger guys. Brock Lesnar is there to hopefully pop a big buy rate, to pop a rating whenever he actually is on television, and to go in there and be an attraction. If you put Brock Lesnar on television every week or every other week, he's not going to mean as much. The days of Brock Lesnar going out there and wrestling guys like Shannon Moore on television and A-Train are over. I don't want to see Brock Lesnar on television beating up the Miz. Well, maybe I would like to see him beating up the Miz, but I don't want to see Brock Lesnar on television wrestling Kofi Kingston and guys like that every week, because then he won't be special anymore. I wish he'd be around a little more often, but I'll take a little bit of Brock over no Brock at all. And you better get used to these part-time deals, because when it comes to a guy like a Chris Jericho or even a Batista, it sounds like Batista is going to be more of a full-time return, although after 6 months he may go away again. But a lot of these older guys, these former big stars who aren't around full-time anymore, if you'll notice, they're giving them more of these part-time deals. They're allowing them to come and go as they please because they realize that, hey, it's better to have these guys for part of the time than not have them at all. So if you're upset that Brock is only around a few times a year and he's only on two pay-per-views a year and doesn't put over younger guys all the time, well, you're going to be a very unhappy person because I think we're going to see more of these types of deals as time goes on. And I say, what took them so long? Because for years, Vince McMahon, it was you're either in or you're out. You either sign on to be full-time and work house shows and everything else, or we're not bringing you back. And in recent years, it seems like he softened his position, and it's not hard to see why, because there has never been a period in this company's history where they had as few a number of real legitimate stars as they do right now. People that, when the fans watch, they see them as a real big-time star. A lot of those guys are gone. They're retired. You know, I mean, a guy like Edge can't even wrestle again, so he's gone. But guys like Jericho or a guy like Goldberg, I mean, there's always rumors of them bringing somebody back. Batista is coming back. You're going to see more of this. And I have no problem with that. I don't see what the big deal is signing a guy, let's say, to a three-month deal or a six-month deal. Rob Van Dam came back. He was only back for about 3 or 4 months. Now he's gone. I don't know when he's coming back. But they brought him back. People went nuts for him. He had a couple of really great TV matches, including that one against Jericho. They used him as a way to put Randy Orton over strong. Last time we saw Van Dam, he got destroyed by Orton on Raw because they wanted a babyface to essentially feed Orton to help get Orton over as this violent, vicious heel. And then he disappeared. And Van Dam will come back whenever he's good and ready to come back. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. Brock's no different. So to say, let's get rid of Brock, is to say the same thing about Jericho and Van Dam. Hey, let's get rid of them too. They're not on TV every week. To me, that's ridiculous. Doug in Ohio, I realize Daniel Bryan is still very over with the people, but do you think they missed a golden opportunity when they didn't let him run with the WWE title? During his feud with Orton and the Authority, he was white hot, and while Bryan is still hot now, I feel it's not quite as much now as it was before. Yeah, I think they missed an opportunity. I mean, look, if they're going to end up putting him in the Rumble, he wins the Rumble, gets the title shot at Mania, wins the belt, that's a nice kind of way to end the story and then give him a run and let him succeed or fail on his own at that point. Doesn't seem like that's the direction they're going in. I don't even know that Bryan really has a direction at Mania. I don't see Shawn Michaels coming back to wrestle him. I don't hear about Bryan being factored into the title picture. So they had something there. They cooled him down a little bit in recent weeks. What direction they're going to go in with him, I don't know. My guess is it doesn't involve the title, so we're not going to get the big payoff to the story that some people were hoping for, and that's a shame. Joshua from Victorville, California, says, been a fan of your show for a while now. One day, as I was browsing your videos on YouTube, and I happened to stumble upon a guy who had an opinion on your review of the Beyond the Mat documentary. He is basically cutting a shoot promo on you. Have you seen it? No, I haven't. Let me give some background first. This is what I talked about earlier in the show. This is unbelievable. This is all in response to a mailbag question I answered back in either August or September, where I talked about Barry Blaustein's Beyond the Mat documentary from 1999. TV Tracks on YouTube posts a lot of clips from my show. I give him permission to post clips, and he posted a short 90-second clip of me talking about this from the show that week. Well, that 90-second clip apparently resulted in a nearly 13-minute-long rebuttal from some guy. We'll just call him Chris. Based on the timestamp, this was back on September 3rd. So this video has been out there for almost 4 months, and I knew nothing about it until Joshua sent me this email and brought it to my attention. And I'm more amused than anything else that someone would take the time to shoot on me, as Joshua puts it, especially because this person completely misunderstood my point. I made one very, very brief remark because I must have talked about Total Divas earlier in that episode, which he would have known had he taken the time to listen to the full show, which he obviously did not. I made one comment to the effect of, forget that Total Divas garbage. Check out Beyond the Mat if you want a more genuine look at some of the behind-the-scenes stuff in WWE, at least how it was 15 years ago. I'm sure some of that's changed since then. Now, I'm not all that interested in giving this person free publicity, but I thought it might be amusing to play some of the audio here from his rant. So if you'll bear with me for a bit, I'm not going to play the entire 13 minutes. I don't think we could survive that, but I'll play a few minutes of it here. I edited the thing down to about 5, and I will chime in here and there where appropriate. We'll have some fun with this. Here we go.
Early today, while I was on my lunch break, I heard listening to a video here on YouTube. It is a person by the name of Solo Monster, and Solo Monster is talking about and giving his opinion on this Beyond the Mat documentary, okay? Now, here's the reason why I'm making this video. Everybody can have an opinion, yes, but when you compare this and say, oh, forget the Total Divas garbage, 20 seconds into the video, that's exactly the words that came out of his mouth. Forget the Total Divas garbage. Go find this and go watch it.
I've never seen somebody get so bent out of shape about absolutely nothing. Like, it's so funny to me.
Okay, well, first of all, I have a problem with that. He is comparing Beyond the Mat to Total Divas, okay?
Right. Except that actually is not what the point of that video was. He took a 3-second remark that I made and blew it up into something that didn't exist. But let's play along anyway.
Total Divas, the TV show Total Divas, and yes, I have an opinion about this. I actually sat through a show. Actually, I've sat through a couple of shows already, and I really kind of just like, kind of want to shoot my brains out. But the thing is, it's like Jersey Shore. It's a hot mess, okay? And to me, Total Divas is exactly what that is. To me, Total Divas is the equivalent to fucking Jersey Shore, okay? Because I watched the last episode, okay? And I got to tell you, especially Nikki and Brie Bella, them two are horny little bitches, okay? Because they are talking about boners, they are talking about orgasms, and in one segment of the show, you see Brie Bella sitting on, like, Nikki, one of the beds that are in Nikki's room, and Brie picks up Nikki's vibrator and throws it at her. It's this little thing that's purple, okay?
Yes, thank you. I know what a vibrator looks like. I love how he has to describe it, too. You know, he has to describe what the vibrator looks like.
But that's what the show is to me. It is a hot mess. It is a train wreck. But now, you know, the guy Solo Monster, yes.
Can I just say, it's kind of freaking me out the way he keeps pronouncing my name as Solo Monster. Tim Morrison used to pronounce it that way back when I interviewed him, the zombie. I don't know. I just find it funny.
On TV Tracks, he has his opinion. He really likes it. He thinks it's a good portrayal of, you know, three superstars in particular, Terry Funk, Jake the Snake Roberts, and Mankind, okay? Mick Foley. And to me, to wait to see the business, the way Beyond the Mat portrays it, has its ups and downs, okay? Because you already know that in the business, especially the WWE, TNA, ROH, and actually any other company, but particularly they paid attention to the WWF because it was WWF still at the time. You've got to know that they have costume designers. The wrestlers aren't going to make up costume designers. They have a music writer. They have pyro people. They have people to put together the stands or the ring, you know, and lay out the chairs and all this and that. Lay out the speaker system, the sound system.
I have no idea what he's babbling about here. I'm not sure what this has to do really with anything. I think it's common knowledge. Yes, WWE has a lot of people who work in a variety of areas behind the scenes, okay? Grass is green and water is wet. I mean, for crying out loud. Unless he's trying to put down Beyond the Mat because it's not showing us anything we don't already know, I have to assume that's the point he's attempting to make here. If he's attempting to make that point, he's not doing a very good job.
To set up catering for the food, they have makeup people. They have, let's see here, good Lord, I mean...
Oh my God, I've got another 2 minutes of this. I don't know if I can continue. Ah, what the hell, we'll continue.
The list is synonymous with what they have, including the wrestlers, okay? But they also have the storyline writers, and they have the people that are going to, you know, of course, they're going to write it. And Vince McMahon kind of oversees some of these things. Thus, sometimes he does need help. But you see the inside look at Beyond the Mat, where you got to know that this, in my opinion, Beyond the Mat is not completely legit. Okay? I think it is legit to a point. I think some things are actually true. But I do find a lot of things are actually false in this DVD.
Mind you, he doesn't give any examples of exactly what he thinks is false in the documentary. Okay, you have scenes like Draws in Vince's office trying to puke. You know, you see Shane McMahon and Jim Ross sitting in the background. I'm sure many similar meetings have taken place in that office over the years. Okay, that's an inside look that we never got to see at that time. The scene of Vince getting all stitched up backstage after the Royal Rumble. Scenes like that, the director was given access that only Paul Jay, the director of Wrestling with Shadows, had. I can't think of another non-WWE documentary where someone has been given access like those men were. I never said it was 100% factual. Of course, it's the director's point of view. That doesn't mean it isn't a good documentary. That doesn't mean there isn't some valuable, legitimate stuff in there. I'm not quite sure what my brief, you know, blink and you'll miss it comment on Total Divas has to do with any of this. Unless he's offended by the notion that I think what we saw in Beyond the Mat is more genuine than what you see behind the scenes on Total Divas. From what I saw of the first three episodes of Total Divas from the beginning of the first season, because I haven't watched it since, it's a lot of fluff. And what you see in terms of backstage footage is pretty pedestrian stuff. You know, in the movie at least, it's more gritty, it's less polished, and you do get a more accurate portrayal of how things are back there, at least back then, than you do based on what I saw in those early episodes of Total Divas. That's all I meant. Context is everything, people. Context is a very important thing.
Even though it says the unrated director's cut, it is exactly what it is. It is the director's cut. It is what the director wants you to see. Okay? So with that being said, I wouldn't believe everything you see on this DVD. I think some of it is, I think it is 50-50 crap, but I think it's also 50-50 true.
Isn't that what Total Divas is? Half crap, half real? The guy flipped out about my comparing Total Divas to Beyond the Mat, which I never actually did, and then he goes and makes the best argument yet for why the two actually might have something in common after all.
It's not the best thing since sliced bread, not in my opinion, but if the solo monster wants to think so, let him. I'm just saying, you know, for him to compare this to Total Divas was a total fucking idiot thing to say. So, kind of needed to call him out on it.
He sure did. He sure called me out on that one. You got me. I don't begrudge this person. I wish him all the best. He's simply misinformed. And apparently had a cold that day, based on all the sniffling in the video. Either that or he's got a bad coke habit. But either way, hopefully he's feeling better.
History has been made here!
It is time for This Week in Wrestling History. We start 31 years ago this week. It was December 25th, Christmas Day, 1982, World Class Championship Wrestling's very first Christmas Star Wars event, which took place in Dallas, Texas, featured one of the most famous angles and the most successful in the history of pro wrestling. It took place during the main event, which was a steel cage match pitting Ric Flair as the visiting NWA World Heavyweight Champion against Kerry Von Erich in a steel cage match for the title with Freebird Michael Hayes as the guest referee. Hayes was chosen to be the referee in storyline because they wanted to have somebody in there who could hold his own because Flair had the rep as winning a lot of his matches and retaining the title in very controversial fashion, low blows and feet on the rope, trunks, that sort of thing. So when Flair had Kerry, or rather Flair and Kerry, both got knocked out during the match, Hayes put Kerry on top of Flair for the pin, but Kerry did not want to win the match that way. An argument ensued. Hayes went to go walk out of the cage. In doing so, though, Flair shoved Kerry into Michael Hayes, knocking him out of the cage. And when Hayes turned around, he only saw Kerry, and he did not know that it was Flair who had caused the shove. And that's when Terry Bam Bam Gordy, another member of the Fabulous Freebirds who was out there, slammed the cage door on Kerry's head, turning the Freebirds heel for what would be a legendary feud with the Von Erichs. I don't think they could do an angle like that today in the modern day and have it be as effective. I mean, and slamming a cage door on somebody's head, I mean, it's something we've seen a whole bunch of times before. But I've been asked questions like, you know, if the NWO turn with Hulk Hogan took place today instead of 1996, if they did it with John Cena, if he went heel, you know, would it have the same business impact or the same overall impact on the company that it did back in the day for WCW? I don't think it could. I just think it's a completely different time in wrestling. I'm not sure what that angle would be, if there even is a single angle that would mean, you know, that much of a difference overall to business like it did back in the day. I wonder sometimes if there is even an angle out there that could be done that would have that same level of impact. I'm not sure there is. 26 years ago this week, on December 27th, 1987, one of the most memorable debuts in the history of pro wrestling took place at Sumo Hall in Tokyo at a New Japan event. It was the very first appearance of Big Van Vader. Giant Vader helmet and all. He wasn't wearing the red leather mask over his face at this point. The way they booked this was just textbook how to get somebody over as a monster in less than 5 minutes. Antonio Inoki, the founder of New Japan, its biggest star, had not lost a match, at least not cleanly, in many years. And he beat Riki Choshu in a very quick main event by DQ. Really wasn't much of a match. All of a sudden, out comes Vader for the very first time. He takes off the helmet. He proceeds to have an impromptu match with Inoki where he destroys him. Just destroys him for 2 or 3 minutes straight. And then pins him with a power slam. Clean in the middle. 1, 2, 3. Video's up on YouTube if you want to watch it. And if you watch the video, you don't see any rioting when the match is over. But supposedly there was rioting by the fans afterwards. They were so shocked and so appalled to see Inoki lose like this. And as a result, New Japan was banned from running another event at Sumo Hall for over a year because of the rioting that did happen. And in one night, Vader went from unknown to legend. Interesting story behind this is that Leon White was not the person originally pegged for the Big Van Vader gimmick. Antonio Inoki's first choice was actually Jim Hellwig, who was portraying Dingo Warrior at the time down in World Class. He was going to come in and be this big super villain, and instead he decided to go to the WWF as the Ultimate Warrior, and I think it's safe to say that things worked out pretty well for him. 20 years ago this week, on December 27, 1993, speaking of Vader, he was beaten by Ric Flair in Flair's hometown of Charlotte, North Carolina. His first match back, I believe, since returning to WCW earlier in the year. This was at Starrcade. Flair won the WCW title in one of the greatest Starrcade main events of all time. That almost never happened. Sid Vicious was supposed to be in Flair's spot and win the world title, but then he almost killed Arn Anderson in that infamous scissors brawl in the hotel overseas and got fired. And from one of the best Starrcade main events, we fast forward 1 year later to one of the worst. Starrcade 94 in Nashville, which featured a main event of Hulk Hogan defeating The Butcher. And I don't mean Abdullah. I'm talking the man of many names, Brutus Beefcake, Zodiac, the booty man, the disciple. He even portrayed a character in WWF at one point called Run-In Man. This was after his parasailing accident when his face got smashed into a million pieces. He only appeared on television a handful of times with the mask on for this gimmick. And they never actually called him Run-In Man. That's just kind of what people have dubbed it over time, Run-In Man. Because what he would do, he would literally run in on matches and attack the heel. And then he would run away. And it was never spoken of again. So anyway, main event sucked. Also on that Starrcade 94 show is a match between Alex Wright and Jean-Paul Levesque. Jean-Paul Levesque being pinned by Alex Wright. This was Triple H's one and only pay-per-view match in WCW before leaving to go to the WWF. 16 years ago this week, on December 28th, 1997, WCW's big Starrcade show featuring a match between Sting and Hollywood Hogan that had been built up for over a year and turned out to be a massive disappointment. The match. The angle was great. The angle was one of the best that WCW had ever done. But the match was a completely different story. This was also the biggest WCW pay-per-view of all time, with 650,000 domestic buys on pay-per-view. Sting beat Hogan for the title, saved WCW from the evil NWO, at least for a couple of months before he lost the belt. But not before Hogan took virtually the entire match. I mean, he beat Sting's ass almost the entire time. And then when he hit the big leg drop, referee Nick Patrick was supposed to fast count Sting. The only problem is, while they sold it as a fast count on commentary, really wasn't. It was a perfectly acceptable, normal three count. So Hogan actually won the match fair and square. Bret Hart, who had just signed with WCW and had been a referee on this show for an earlier match, he came out. He looked like a complete bully coming down to the ring and attacking the referee for this phantom fast count that never actually happened. There was also supposed to be a Kevin Nash versus Giant match on this show. That was the number two match being promoted, but Nash no-showed the event. It's been said that he had a legit heart scare and was in the hospital. I think even Eric Bischoff mentioned that in his book. So that's why he couldn't make the show. And I know it runs in his family. I believe it. I completely believe that he had a legit heart scare. They told him he was losing to the Giant, and his heart nearly stopped beating. 15 years ago this week, on December 27th, 1998, Starrcade was yet another nail in the WCW coffin. The night that Kevin Nash handed Bill Goldberg his very first loss to end the streak and win the WCW World Heavyweight title. 1 week later came the infamous finger poke of doom, with Hogan winning the belt back from Nash and reforming the original NWO, which ended up breaking apart again only a few months later. That was the same night Bischoff told Tony Schiavone to go ahead on commentary and spoil Mankind's title win that was happening on Raw and talk about how that'll put some butts in seats. It was just one of the colossal fuck-ups, one fuck-up after another that company made during this period, and we see the end result of that. 10 years ago this week, on December 25th, 2003, WWE aired its very first Tribute to the Troops show at Camp Victory in Baghdad, Iraq. It had been taped several days earlier. The show was the brainchild of John Layfield. It was his idea. And lives on to this day. They actually had Tribute to the Troops air this weekend on NBC. I caught the opening match. It was kind of silly because it started out as a singles match between Bray Wyatt and Daniel Bryan, went to a DQ. Then it turned into a tag match, Punk and Bryan against the Wyatt family, and then another DQ. And then finally it became the six-man tag with John Cena, CM Punk and Bryan against the Wyatt family, with Cena beating, I think it was Luke Harper with the attitude adjustment. So again, it's kind of like the Christmas show. It's just a feel good show for the troops. I actually kind of like the setup for it. It's different every year. The army base, I guess they had it on this year. They created their own little mini arena, but you could still tell it was cold. You know, you're basically still outside. You know, you could see when they would wrestle the breath coming out of their mouth. But I don't know. I like it. I've said before that you watch Raw every week and SmackDown, even some of the pay-per-views, just the Tron, the aisleway, the way everything is set up, it's so boring. It's the same thing every week. If you really watch Raw, the look and the feel and the setup for Monday Night Raw, the aisle and everything else, nothing has really changed since 1997. Very little has changed. They have a big fancy HD screen now. That's about the only difference. So when you watch a show like this, it's kind of fun because it's a different setting, right? It looks different. It feels different. I'm telling you, man, they got to shake up that look. I know they put a lot of money into that HD screen. They're probably not going to do anything with it for a while, but I really wish they would change the look of Raw. Just change the aisleway, change the staging, do something, make it look different, freshen it up. But anyway, back to this show here. Stone Cold Steve Austin was dressed as Santa Claus. He gave Vince McMahon a stunner. And after the main event between John Cena and The Big Show, Austin gave stunners to both of them as well. So, yes, there is footage online of John Cena eating a Stone Cold stunner. I'm sure all the Cena haters out there are well aware of the clip. And they've probably already fapped to it at least five times this morning. 7 years ago this week, on December 23rd, 2006, we'll end with this. Ring of Honor held its final battle event at the Manhattan Center in New York City. I was there. It was only my third ROH show at the time. My first one was in June of that year. That was the final show they ever had in the ballroom at the New Yorker Hotel, which is, anybody who lives in New York knows, the New Yorker is literally right around the corner from the Manhattan Center. And it was good that they moved out of there. It was for the better, because every time somebody would come off the top rope, they nearly hit the chandelier that was hanging from the ceiling. It's kind of a problem. I think at the time, Jimmy Rave was also, he was doing a gimmick where people would throw toilet paper at him. And people threw the toilet paper, and the toilet paper got hooked, like it was all over the chandelier. And I think there were a lot of very pissed off people about that. That was also the show where Bryan Danielson nearly killed me on a dive into the crowd onto Samoa Joe and Kenta in the front row. And years later, when I had the chance to interview Bryan over WrestleMania weekend in Miami, and I told him the story, he laughed in my face. That little goat-faced troll. Anyway, Jay and Mark Briscoe beat the Kings of Wrestling in what was supposed to be Claudio Castagnoli's final match before heading to WWE. And when the match was over, he cut a promo and said he might actually be sticking around a little bit longer, as it turned out. So he must have known at that point things had hit a snag with WWE. He was supposed to go, you know, Antonio Cesaro was supposed to be in WWE many years before he was. And I think what happened was there may have been some sort of visa issue, and they soured on him. And there were a lot of people at the time very upset because they thought that might be it for him. Thankfully, you know, many years later, he got another shot and became Antonio Cesaro, and now he's working his way up. I think the sky's the limit for him, but he's finally in WWE working his way up. He's a star now, or a bigger star, I should say. And this was also the Ring of Honor debut of Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney as Chris Hero's new agent. That guy could have been something special as a manager in WWE or TNA. It's a shame he took his own life. I really think he was the closest thing we had, really, in the modern era to a Bobby Heenan or a Jim Cornette-type manager in wrestling. Paul Heyman is awesome, don't get me wrong. And Heyman came back along in that role many years later, but when Sweeney was around, he was the closest thing we had to that. And I really think that, you know, I know he had issues with bipolar disorder and stuff, and that kind of led to him taking his life. But were it not for that, I really think he could have been a much bigger star on TV for one of those two companies. And in the main event, Homicide beat Bryan Danielson to become Ring of Honor World Champion for the first time, ending Bryan's 15-month reign with the title. When I think of Ring of Honor champions, the two guys I always think of first are Samoa Joe and Bryan Danielson. Those guys made that belt. They made that company. I remember this being a really hot show at the time, just a lot of fun. I don't go to ROH shows as often as I used to, but that whole period back then opened my eyes to a whole new world when it came to independent wrestling. I just wasn't going to many of those shows. When I started with ROH, every time out, it was always a blast. So it's kind of like I said earlier, if WWE comes to town for a house show and you're on the fence, oh, should I go or not? For 20 or 30 bucks a ticket, go. And if there's a Ring of Honor show or an independent show in your area, and again, tickets are not, I mean, how expensive can tickets possibly be? Go. If you're a fan, go, because you'll have fun. You know, you don't need the biggest names and the top stars. Just go and have a good time, because a lot of times you'll have more fun going to a wrestling show like that than you will going to one of the mainstream shows. So I always encourage people, if they come to your area, go. You'll have a good time. That's going to do it for this week. We'll wrap things up here. If you have mailbag questions, please keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I'm trying to get to them as quickly as I can. So please send me emails there. You can also follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster, and subscribe to our channel on YouTube. There have been two new videos that have gone up in the last 2 weeks. I had my NXT 200 review. Again, this past week's Raw review for the Christmas show is up on YouTube. It's about a 20-minute review for that, if you want to go check that out. But subscribe. Every time a new video goes up, you will be notified. We're all over Facebook, so find us on there. We have a profile page, which is our main page, but we also have a fan page that you can like, and a private, closed discussion group that you can apply for membership. I'll approve you. And we have a nice community of well over 800 members, many of whom, not all 800, but many of them are very active. So find us on there and be part of our little family. So this is the final sound-off of 2013. And this has been a good year for the show. It was a big year for the show, a year of transition, of, as many of you know, and as some of you don't, because I still get messages about this. Over the summer, we parted ways with SEScoops.com. Which is still a great website. You should check it out for your wrestling fix each day. And we parted ways over the summer, and the show has continued on and has done even better than I thought it would. You know, there's always a fear when something like that happens, and SE Scoops has a very large audience that exposed our show to a lot of new people who probably otherwise would not have known about it. And there's always a fear, okay, now that that's over, you know, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, how will new people find the show? And I also have to give a big shout-out to TV Tracks, because his YouTube channel, over 30,000 subscribers, one of the most popular channels on YouTube when it comes to wrestling discussion. He's been a big fan of the show for a long time. Even before the split with SE Scoops, he was posting clips from the show, but even more so since then. And I think he was a very big help in that, in terms of just, you know, keeping us out there and exposing us to a whole new audience. And I can honestly sit here and tell you that our audience now is as big as it's ever been, and it continues to grow. We bring in new listeners every week. You guys are a big part of that. So again, the more people that you can tell, friends, family, if you know people who are wrestling fans, oh, hey, do you listen to the Sound Off? No? Well, maybe you should. And that's how the word spreads. So the more you guys spread the word, the better off we are. There's a million different ways for you to listen to the show. I didn't mention Stitcher. You can stream us on Stitcher Radio. Put us on your playlist on there. We're on the sports charts, usually in the top 15. We're hovering around there. And, of course, we have a free app in the Google Play Store. If you have an Android device, you can stream us that way. We're in iTunes. So keep supporting the show. Know that I appreciate it. You can always make a PayPal donation as well if you want to directly support the show. But 2013 was a really good year for the show, our sixth. And now as we enter 2014, we begin our seventh year on the air, hopefully with many more to come. And hopefully you join me for the ride. So until next week, we'll have our first show of the new year. Be well. Stay safe, especially if you guys are doing anything special over New Year's, if you're like any of these crazy people who are going to Times Square in New York or anything like that. Definitely stay safe. Have a happy new year. We will see you again in 2014. And until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I gotta get rid of this vest. I gotta get this club. This club sucks.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solomonster Sounds Off.